So we are starting a new series next week, and the series next week is called Vision Walk, and it's actually, we're going to be going through the book of Nehemiah, for those of you who like to know what's behind the series. The book of Nehemiah, we're going to try to figure out when, we move from the vision of God to walking the walk, right? Because we get this vision, but how do you turn that into actual steps you can take? And Nehemiah is a great book of the Bible for that, because that's what happens with him. He gets his vision, and gets, his heart broken about something, and God's moved him, and then he accomplishes amazing things, and we're going to walk through the book of Nehemiah with him and show you that. So that starts next week. So this is my last time to actually kind of preach one off series, kind of pick one and preach it, and I prayed about this for some time as well, and I just feel like we talked about this beginning last year, January, if some of you remember, we talked about how things were going to change for Spirit Chapel in 2017, and we're going to be doing a pivot, and we just kind of felt that was going to happen, and it sort of has, and I think it's going to continue on this season as well. We're in our fifth year as a church. This is our last year of the lease here at Swiss Alpine Village. I've met with Dan, the owner of Swiss Alpine Village. He says, you guys can stay as long as you want. I'll never raise your rent. We'd love to have you guys stay forever, so we're not getting kicked out. As much parking space as we take sometimes, you wonder, but they're fine with it. Loves having us here, so that's not an issue. But I just believe that we're not going to be forced out, but I believe God's calling us out. And I think that he has a move to make with us, and I want to talk to you about that a little bit today. There's been a couple times in our lives when I think you felt like you're in the middle of God's will. I mean, I hope every Christian sometime feels that way. It's a kind of a sweet spot as a Christian when you feel you're there. And he's like, I love living when I feel like I'm right where God wants me. It doesn't happen all the time, but it does happen occasionally. The best part, though, is when you think, I'm right where God wants me, and then you realize he was there before you. And so he was already there waiting for you to catch up, and you realize that you're in a plan that he put together before time began. And this just kind of just overwhelms you with the awesomeness of God. My father said something once that I thought was really, really good. He said, God's hands are always moving in our lives, but occasionally he lets them linger long enough for us to catch a glimpse of them. And I think that's probably true. Every now and then he kind of just slows down enough so we catch that glimpse of his hand, and it goes back to its normal speed, which is angel speed, and you can't see it. We had a situation happen about half a year after we were here at Spirit Chapel. I met with a woman who'd come to visit. And turns out she was the neighbor of the person who owned this land that all the Swiss Alpine Village is on. And she says, I got to tell you something about him. He was a Christian, and he had this vision, to put Swiss Alpine Village Shopping Center here in the middle of at the time, cow pasture. And she said, I was standing with him, and he was pointing out where he's going to put the road and, how he's going to have two layers of different shops and things. He says, and then right up here, and he points up to this hill, he says, I'm going to put a little tiny building, I'm going to put a steeple on it. That's going to be the chapel, because every Swiss Alpine Village has a chapel where the people meet and pray. And then he's quiet for a moment. He says, but it's my prayer that one day a real chapel will be on that property and people will meet there and pray. And his prayer got answered, I believe, in November of 2013, when 21 people gathered in this building for the first time, and the words, would you pray with me, were said. And we all bowed our heads in prayer. And I just think, at that moment she told me that, you feel like you're part of something else, and you start getting kind of excited. I think we're getting ready to be moved into another one of those times. We've been talking for some time about how we've been praying for a building or some place we could call our own. It's been great to be here, but we don't like sending our kids into a different building. We don't like not having all of our ministries under one roof. And we've been praying about that, and it's hard. It's a very hard thing to do these days, because there's a lot of reasons. But it's very difficult for a church to do that now. And if you don't have the umbrella protection of another church, which we don't have. And so we're kind of praying and say, God, we don't know how you're going to do this, but you're God of the impossible, and we just need an impossible thing here. So we've been praying about that, and some of you joined with us. We started that in January. Sometime around summer, some of you noticed that our conversation about it sort of changed a little bit, and some people were coming up to me and said, do you have a place? And I said, well, we kind of have a place in mind right now, and we believe that God is going to give it to us, but we're not sure how yet, because it's going to take a miracle. And so people want to know what that place is, and we've been trying to be fairly, you know, tight-lipped about it because we just don't think it's appropriate to go talking about things that God hasn't made clear yet. And but some people become amateur detectives and they're looking around, you know, do you mean this? Do you mean this? It's really kind of funny, some of the conversations we've had, and some of them have figured it out. But I had about a month and a half ago, a couple came to Saturday night service, and afterwards I was talking to them, and they've been in the township a long time, and they said, I hear that you're thinking about a building. Are you going to move out of the township and build a building? I said, no. You know, for whatever reason, I believe God brought us here, and he literally wants us where we are. We're exactly where he meant us to be, and so this is our ministry. That's how we feel about it. Unless he changes my heart, we'll never leave Elizabeth Township because we believe he brought us here for a purpose. And so we start talking a little more, and she says, I hear you kind of have something in mind, and I said, yeah, and I really don't want to talk about it. And then she says, is it? And she names the place exactly that we were talking about. And I thought, wow, okay, got us, you know, got it. That's true, you know, don't want to tell anybody necessarily, but yeah, you're right. And she says, did you know that place used to be a church? I said, yeah, actually, I do know. And she said, I used to go to that church. I said, really? And she says, yeah. She says, but before it was a church, it was a kind of something that a group of people, Christians, came together. They wanted to create a kind of Christian community thing. And so we actually acquired, I don't know if they bought or acquired that land originally before it was a church. She said, I was actually part of that group before it was even a church. I said, wow, that's, I didn't know that part. And then she says, I don't know how you feel about this, but there was a prophecy given over that property. Did you know that? I said, no. She said, I don't know how you feel about prophecy. I said, well, I do not despise prophecies because that's what we're told. I said, I'd love to hear it. And she says, well, basically we were up there just in lawn chairs praising God and having a little prayer service, and suddenly somebody started speaking and said, I think God's giving me a prophecy for this, you know, for this venture, for this property. And she says, it used to be there was fruit trees all around it. It was almost like an orchard kind of thing, and all kind of different kinds of fruit trees. And she said, the prophecies told us, because we're all praying, says, look up, look around. See the fruit on the tree. I will make this land fruitful in my name, and it will flow and bless the entire township. And I said, wow, that's really an incredible prophecy. Then she got sad. She goes, but it never happened. She says, and I don't know why. We ended up giving it to another place who built a church, and it went through several hands. And she says, I always wondered why, because when it was spoken, it felt in my spirit like it was right. I believed it was true, and it never happened. And it passed from hand to hand, and the church never really thrived, never really prospered. And after a time, it just, you know, eventually became empty. And she says, I don't understand that. I really don't. I've every now and then I've prayed to God, what happened, you know? And she says, I know men get involved and, you know, that has something to do with it, but I just never understood why he would give us a prophecy that didn't come true. And so I said, well, you know, sometimes God takes us to the promised land, but without our obedience, we can't enter. And then she asked me, do you mind me asking what your plans for that are? I said, well, you know, I'm still waiting for my marching orders from the Lord, exactly. But here's, you kind of in general, we believe the first and foremost purpose of every church is to introduce people to Jesus Christ and make them disciples. So that's, you know, clearly what our mission is. But beyond that, I have something that's been on my heart for some time, that I believe that we are creative people. We are created in the image of a creative God. We're supposed to be a creative people. And I think our generation has had that stolen from them by technology. The new generation has become consumers, not producers. And I think a lot of kids are bored today not knowing what to do because they don't know how to create. And they haven't found an outlet for creativity, which God put in them. And I just think they'll never be satisfied. So we would like to have a creative center. We would like to teach people, especially middle school, how to use things like the Adobe Creative Suites, you know, the video and editing and the imagery. But as well as that, we want to do music. You know, we want to teach music and teach people how to, you know, just create for God. And I think that if we reconnect them to this creative nature, they're going to find a fulfillment that they're missing right now. And they're going to find it in creating for the Creator, and that's kind of our goal. And she kind of teared up, and she says, if that happens, the prophecy will be fulfilled. So I was thinking, this is really interesting because we're literally talking about a promise on land, and if that doesn't define promised land, I don't know what does. And so as I was trying to think about what's the last sermon to preach of 2017 before we start into what I think is going to be a pivotal year for the church, it's probably a good idea to go back and take a look at the Israelites. when they moved into the Promised Land, because that's a scary thing. I don't know if those of you have been here long enough to remember all the sermons that have been preached, because we did a whole series on the exit strategy that we talked about Moses, and we did another whole series on Joshua called The Champions. And it's not easy getting into the Promised Land. You have to know that. I mean, I think a lot of people think once the promise is there, you just get it. But that's not how it works. I want to go back and I want to take a look at it, because there's lessons here and there's warnings here for the teaching leading of the church, for the elders and the leadership of the church, and for the people of the church inside of what happens, literally what goes wrong the first time the Israelites try to approach the Promised Land. So I want to talk about that. So in Numbers 10 is when it happens. Moses says, "We're setting out to the place which the Lord said, I will give to you. Come with us. We will do good, for the Lord has promised good concerning Israel." So they all mount up. You know, they get their Ark of Covenant. It goes out in front of them. They travel 3 days to seek out the final resting place, which is the Promised Land. The cloud of the Lord is moving before them, and it's like, man, finally, we're going home. You know, and I just feel like some Christians, if I told you that, boy, God is going to move you to the Promised Land, here we go, and you're thinking, how are we going to get there? Well, clear, it's something more like this.
Then close your eyes and tap your heels together 3 times and think to yourself, there's no place like home. There's no place like home.
There's no place like home. There's no place.
There's no place like home. That's all you have to do, right? And then you're there. You're in the Promised Land. It's not the way it works. You got to know. It's not that simple. We don't just have magic little ruby sandals that we click together, and there we go. We're there. There is a certain amount of character building that has to go on before we get there. And once we get there, it's going to be a fight. And that's the lesson of the Promised Land. It's not, you know, it's a promise, but it's a promise with a fight. So let's talk about that, because what happens the first time they march up to that is 3 things happen. First of all, leadership breaks down because of jealousy and pride. Then we see the people completely fail the test of faith. And then finally, for the first time in all the chapters, we see the leader, the vision leader, the one that God put in place to lead them, Moses, who's been amazing this whole time. He has his first failure as a leader. And so I'm going to kind of walk through those one by one. The first thing that happens is they approach the Promised Land. They see it in the distance. They're kind of there near the Jordan River, and they can see out in the Promised Land. Is all of a sudden, Miriam and Aaron, Moses' brother and sister, decide, you know what? We think we can come in here and be leaders now. It's funny how no one wanted to be the leader in the wilderness, isn't it? You know, they weren't stepping up in those days when the people were talking about, you know, stoning him. When Moses went off and they were worried about if he's coming back, Aaron didn't want to be a leader. He just did whatever they wanted. You want me to build you a Baal calf? I'll go build you a Baal calf. You know, that's not a leader, by the way. That's called a follower. And so it's funny how when they were in the wilderness, nobody wanted to be a leader. But now they're on the edge of the Promised Land, and all of a sudden there's a power struggle that happens. They say, look, God didn't just speak through Moses. He speaks through us too. So, you know, we should be leaders here too. We should have some kind of a triumphant here where we all can be a leader. And this funny thing, this parenthetical here says, we need to basically take over here and be equals. And then it says, now the man Moses was very humble, more than any man who's on the face of the earth. Now this cracks me up, because this book was written by Moses, right? So he's writing about himself here. Now Moses was humble. Now some people actually believe he had a scribe that actually threw this one in there when the master wasn't looking. But anyway, but Moses was. He was a very humble man. It was amazing how he dealt with it. Clearly the best civic leader of all time, Moses. It's an amazing thing that Moses did. Well, God will step in, and he will curse Miriam with leprosy. That got their attention. And she actually has to go back to the people and ask for their prayers for her to be healed. And so God humbled her in front of the people that she was trying to take over leadership. It is amazing. You've probably heard the expression, every success has many fathers, but every failure is an orphan. Have you ever heard that? Well, that's kind of it. No one wants to lead in the wilderness, but everyone wants to take credit for the Promised Land. You know, it is amazing how this happened. We've actually kind of seen it here a little bit too. You know, it was like in the early days, no one wanted to be taking over the leadership. We've actually had someone step back up. So, you know, I could come and lead that now. Well, thank you. Thank you very much. But we're good. We're coming out of the promise. We're coming out of the wilderness. I think we're okay. The next thing that happened is the people fail. So they kind of get all that worked out. And now God comes to Moses and he gives him very, very explicit instructions. He says, send out for yourself men so they can spy into the land of Canaan, which I am going to give it to the sons of Israel. Now, he gives them specific instructions. They're supposed to go and they're supposed to look to see how good the land is. And Moses actually, you know, adds to that. Because, and this is funny, he says, I want you to see the grapes. And I want you to see the pomegranates. Pomegranates was a big thing to Moses. He wanted to know if the pomegranates were good. I probably need to relook at pomegranates because I've never seen the big attraction. But Moses, he specifically told him, bring back pomegranates. I want to see the pomegranates. So they're supposed to go there to see that the promised land is everything that God told them it was going to be. That's what they're out there for. That's their mission. So they send them out there. And so they go out and they return back. They said, yeah, we went out there where you sent us. And yep, you're right. It is flowing with milk and honey. And this is its fruit. And they had some grapes that were so big, they had to put them on a pole between two men to carry it. I mean, this thing was just beautiful, right? And then they add this. Nevertheless, the people who live in the land are strong. The cities are fortified and very large. And we saw descendants of Anak there. Anak was a very well-known race of giants. And so they said, we saw the good stuff, but let me tell you the bad stuff. That was not what they were sent there for. They were not military spies. They were farmers, right? Which tells how the farmland looks. They come back and say, oh, forget that. The people are huge, and the cities are fortified, and there's no way we're going to be able to get in there. And then Caleb, one of the two spies that believed in God, said, no, look, we should by all means go up, and we will surely overcome it. But the men who went up with them said, we will not be able to. They are too strong for us. And then to make sure that everybody hears it, they go out from Moses where they gave the report, and they told everybody else. They spread it through all the people. They went out and they told everybody. It says, look, the land which we've gone spying out is a land that devours its inhabitants. Notice they left out all the other stuff now. Now they're just talking about the bad stuff. All the people we saw are huge men of great size. We became like grasshoppers in our own sight. It is amazing how when we focus on our problems, we look like grasshoppers before them, right? And so this is what happened, is that there's just no way that we can possibly do it. Their report, though, is this. The promise is real. The land that God promised to bring us to is completely real. There's no way we can get it. This is an amazing thing. It's like, yeah, God's promise, yeah, okay, the land is exactly what it's supposed to be, but there's no way that we're going to get it. See, many Christians believe that God can do anything, but that he will do nothing. I meet these Christians all the time. Yes, God can do anything, not for me, you know, not for the church, but boy, we know he can. You know, he can just do anything. What we have to understand is we're calling God a liar if we have said, he gave me this promise, but he can't do it. In fact, he says this in Psalm 89, my covenant I will not break, nor alter a single word that goes out of my lips. God always keeps his promise. Now, it doesn't mean he does everything you ask. That's not what I said. I didn't say he answers all your prayers. I'm saying that which God promises, God does. And he had promised them that he was going to take them into there. But they couldn't have the faith to do it. So they basically said, we can't do this. And because of that, not because of leadership, not because God changed his mind, like maybe I can't do it, but because the people didn't have the faith to believe God's promise, he said, okay, let's round through the wilderness again. You guys clearly don't deserve this. I want you to see, they were at the promised land, but God didn't give it to them because of lack of faith. So just because we're approaching a promised land doesn't mean we're going to see the promise. Because God is looking for a certain people, because in the promise he talks about joining him in his rest. The promise is to be with God. If you can't believe in God, who are you going to be with? So what happens is they kind of turn around, they start leaving, and the Israelites panic a little bit. They didn't mean to leave. They just meant to not cross the river. They liked the river. Then they could see the water. So they had water. But now they're heading back out in the wilderness. Now, mind you, the way they get their path is the pillar of smoke, the cloud of smoke moves, and they follow it, and that's how they go. So the pillar starts moving back out, and all of a sudden the people start panicking again. You know, this isn't the first time this has happened. And they start complaining, where are we going to get water? We're leaving a river? You nuts? Where are we going to get water? We're going to die. We're going to die. We have no water. We're going to die. Look, our canteen, it's like 3/4 full. Yesterday it was full. It's going to be empty tomorrow. You know, we're going to die. And so they come to Moses and said, where's our water? Now Moses has heard this before more than once. And God comes to Moses and he says, okay, don't worry about it. I'm not killing them. If he wanted to kill me, could have. But that's not what he's doing. He says, Lord speaks to Moses, says, I want you to take that rod and your brother Aaron and go gather the congregation together and then speak to the rock before their eyes. Let them watch. And it will yield its waters, and you'll bring water out from the rock to everybody. And so Moses grabs his rod, gets his brother, they go on up, they stand before the rock, everything's set. We've done this before, by the way, and Moses is getting ready to perform another miracle for the people. But now all of a sudden, Moses decides he's going to turn this into his General Patton moment. You know, the big flag. He stands up there before the men. He's going to show his leadership. And we don't really know why suddenly he decides to do that. But I think it was just he was worried about mutiny. So they mutinied before, but they always had the promise of the promised land before. Now they're moving away from the promised land. How is he going to keep these people together? Well, he's clearly going to have to be a better leader than he's been. And so that's why I think all of a sudden he turns into General Patton. And so he starts giving this fiery speech before everybody. He says, listen now, you rebels. Shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock? Who's we? He's standing there with Aaron. Shall we bring forth water now for you people? Do you not trust your leadership? And he takes his rod and he strikes the rock twice with it and the water pours out. Why did he do that? God didn't tell him to strike the rock. In fact, God said, speak to the rock and I'll make water come out. So why in the world would he do that? Well, I think part of the reason why he did that was because he wanted to show that he was leading and so people could trust him. But the problem when you're God's leader is people don't have to trust you, they have to trust God. All they have to know is that you speak for God, that they need to trust. But after that, they have to trust God. It has nothing to do with him. And so when that happens, God tells them, you know what? Because you have not believed me, and you did not treat me as holy in the sight of the sons of Israel, you won't get in the promised land either. Now, I've said this before. I'm not so sure this was a curse. I mean, I think poor Moses had it anyway. You notice he never complains about the, okay, you know, I don't know. It's like someone else wants to take over now. I'm almost okay with that. Poor Moses, 40 years of this. I don't know. But it is a sad thing that he will never enter into the promised land. God will take him up to the hill and show it to him. But he will never enter into this thing that he has worked so hard to bring everybody to. But what God's basically saying, look, when I allow you to speak for me, don't act like I'm not there. You're being my spokesperson because I've let you be my spokesperson, but it's still God that's doing everything. And sometimes I think preachers need to understand this. You know, sometimes preachers get really pretty full of themselves. And let me put it another way. If Jesus is to be lifted up, we're going to have to remain seated. I think sometimes we like to stand up in front of God's glory and try to take some of it, like Chanticleer taking credit for the sunrise. You know, it's like, no, if Jesus is to be lifted up, we're going to stay seated. And we have to be okay with that. You know, I've said more than once, someone asked me once about something that happened here that was really pretty cool, but it wasn't me. It was a video, the clip I played of another preacher. And someone said, must have bothered you a little bit that was the best part of the sermon. I said, nope, our motto here is it doesn't matter who gets the credit as long as God gets the glory. So, you know, that's fine. We got to stay seated if Jesus is to be lifted up. Okay, but the other thing you have to understand is it did work the first time for Moses. 40 years before, he did the same thing. Only this time God instructed him to strike the rock. And he struck the rock. So what's the difference between then and there? The difference is obedience. The first time he was striking the rock out of obedience. The second time he was striking the rock to steal God's glory. It's not your actions that matter to God. It's the heart that matters to God. Miracles are not a response to our actions, they're a response to our obedience. They saw the miracles, that all these things, that the signs and wonders that God did through Moses didn't happen because of anything he did. It was because he was obedient what God told him to do. And we have to understand that. The one other thing I will have to add about this is I think this was a fear that Moses always had, that the people wouldn't follow him. He never felt good about a leader. God, when he met him at the burning bush, if you remember back in those days, the very first time he meets him, the very first thing he says to God when he said, I want you to go and lead your people out of Egypt, he's not worried about the Egyptians, which he probably should be, you know, the most powerful army on earth. He's worried about the Israelites. He says, now suppose I go to the Israelites, God, just, you know, spitballing here for a minute, just suppose I do what you say, and I tell them the God of your father sent me to you, and they ask me, yeah, what's his name? What shall I say to them? See, he's actually worried the Israelites won't follow him. He can't even get to the Egyptians. He's worried the Israelites aren't going to follow him. And of course, God very famously gives a really cool answer here. I want to break this down just a second, and I've done this before. But what's God going to say to that question? Think about that for a minute. Because Moses is from Egypt. He spent time in Egypt. Egyptians had a god for everything, right? They had the sun god, the death god. They had the little tiny cricket that was a god. They had frogs that were a god. Do you realize every plague that was brought upon the Egyptians mocked an Egyptian god? Every one of them. And they could have gone on for days and days and days with plagues. They had a lot more than just 10. They had Ra, the sun god. They had the death god. They had the Nile River was worshipped as a god. Every one of those frogs, every one of those was a god. So what happened when Egyptians did this is like, well, Ra is the sun god. He's the most powerful god because the sun's the most powerful thing. The Nile is the giver of life because it's like that. So when Moses is asking God, what is your name? He's also asking him, what is your nature? Who are you? Your name in those days described who you were, which is why they would sometimes change them when they changed who they were. And so he's saying, who are you? What are you like? Well, what's God going to say? Well, I'm kind of like the sun, but brighter. I'm kind of like the Nile, but bigger. You know, what's he going to say? God can't compare himself to anything else on earth because everything else on earth was created. God was not. The one single most defining characteristic of God is he was never created. Other things may be everlasting. God is everlasting to everlasting. Uncreated. The single defining characteristic of God. And because of that, he can't compare himself to anything. So what he does is cool. He compares himself to himself. He says, tell them I am who I am, sent me. I compare myself to myself. Because there's nothing else you can compare me to. That's who. That's what you'll tell the Israelites. I am that I am. Now, of course, the Israelites consider that such a holy word, they won't write it down. So they changed a couple letters, and from that we get the word Jehovah. Jehovah is as close as they've written down to what his name really is. They won't write the Holy of Holies name. It's really weird. If you go on a Jewish website, they actually won't write the word God either. They'll do God underscore D. I don't understand that. But you know, they're very careful about this because it's to be kept reverent and holy. So what we have is Jehovah. That's as close as we can come to speaking the name of God. And that's what we're given in the Bible. But we have to understand that it was the doubt and the disobedience that kept the people from the promise. And Paul comes back to this in Hebrews. And he's telling them, look, you guys have to be careful here because you've had a new promise given to you by Jesus Christ, the promise of salvation. But if you act now to Jesus like others act during Moses' day, you're going to have the same result that they had because this is what matters, your heart. And he says this, he says, the Holy Spirit, you know, he says, I'm speaking now for the Holy Spirit. Today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as Israel did in the rebellion. During the time of testing in the wilderness, where they tested and tried me. Do you know what that means? That means every time God told them to do something, they said, well, prove yourself first. You know, day one, God's okay with that. You know, but by day, whatever 40 years goes by, I can't do the math. Whatever that day was, they're still saying, prove it. God says, I'm done proving it. I've proved it over 40 years. Have you not been paying attention? Do you not see the pillar of smoke? Do you not remember the Egyptian army I wiped out? And that was not the only battle they won, by the way. Did you not see the flock that came down so you could all eat? Have you not eaten manna every day? Have your sandals not worn out? Not one bit. Their sandals never worn out their whole time they were there. Why are you asking me to prove myself again? That's testing the Lord. When he's told you to say, prove it and I'll do it. And I'm telling you, there's a lot of Christians say, well, if God would actually come down here and tell me, I would do it. Are you not paying attention to what he's doing in your life? Okay, he says, that's a hard heart. You can't do that. And he says, this is why I was angry with that generation. And I said, their hearts are always going astray. You know why? Because they have not known my ways. They don't even know who I am. It's not just they don't know my law. They don't know who I am. They clearly don't understand who I am. And because of that, they are not going to enter into the promised land. And so what Paul says, brothers and sisters, be careful. Your own hearts don't get hard. It'll turn you away from the living God. Keep warning each other. Right now, don't let your heart get hard so that none of you will be deceived by sin and have your heart hardened against God. For if we are faithful to the end, doesn't matter how you start, matters how you finish, to the end, then God, trusting God just as firmly as we first believe, we will share in all that belongs to Christ. Remember what it says. Today, when you hear his voice, don't harden your hearts as Israel did when they rebelled. And then he sums the whole thing up and says, the people sinned and their corpses stayed in the wilderness. See, sometimes we forget that because we know eventually Israel enters into the promised land, but not those people. They all died off. And the funniest thing about it to me, or tragic thing maybe, is that throughout the entire time, they're always worrying that they're going to die in the wilderness. That's like their big thing. Did God bring us in the wilderness to die? And that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy for them because they disobey God. And they just won't believe him when he tells them that. He says, their corpses lay in the wilderness today. It was the next generation that enters into the promised land. Joshua, Caleb, that's it. Everybody else, including Moses and Aaron and Miriam, die. They never see the promised land. The only thing that can keep you from God's promise is your sin and disbelief. God's promises are true and they will come true. But it's not guaranteed if you walk away. You can walk up to the edge of the promised land and go, yeah, I don't think so, walk away. God's not chasing you. If you can't believe in God, you cannot enter into the promised land. So who do you believe? Who is your God? See, there are many names of God given to us in the Old Testament. I'm going to go through three of them because I think these three kind of go together in a very powerful way. First of all, is El Shaddai. El Shaddai, I mean, we sing it sometimes in the song. You guys may know the song El Shaddai. What does it mean? It means God Almighty. All power and all might belongs to God. God Almighty, El Shaddai. Do you believe that? Because I believe that we kind of conceptually believe it, but we don't actually believe it. Because if you really believe God could do anything, then you wouldn't be afraid of anything, right? And so it's very hard, though. There's another really great word for God, Jehovah Raha. There's actually a ch in there, Raha. I can't do Jewish pronunciations very well. It means the Lord is my shepherd. That means you follow him. Do you? How do you know if you follow him? Well, when you're making your plans, does God enter into it? You know, the chapter of James says, look, you say I'm going to go here and do this and do that. And says, you fools. You need to say, if God wills, I'll go there and do that. He says, you need to bring God into your planning here because he's supposed to be leading you. The sheep follow the shepherd, whether he's in the valley or he's in the mountain. The sheep just follow the shepherd. They don't worry about their surroundings. They keep their eye on the shepherd, and they follow him. And I believe that the only way you get to be to God who you follow, God the shepherd, and the only way you're going to lead to God is Almighty, is if you get the first one right. This is the first one, the most important, that God always tries to teach new believers. Jehovah Jireh. Now remember, this starts with Jehovah. I am, he's saying, Jireh, the God who provides. In other words, he's the one that I trust. Now, we like to talk about trust and we like to talk about faith. In God we trust. It's on our money. If Mr. Saccone has anything to say, it'll be on every public building. In God we trust, do we? Do we trust in God? Or when we look at our money and say, in God we trust, are we really saying that's what we trust in? Is this our God? Because here's how you know. If you believe in Jehovah Jireh, I'm going to tell you, you're not going to like it. I'm going to warn you up front, you're not going to like it. Do you tithe? Because if the answer to that question is no, then you don't truly believe in Jehovah Jireh. And I know that I upset people, but there's one way I can be sure to upset people is to talk about money. And we don't do it much here. We don't even pass a collection plate. We started the church. We talked to people before we started. Why did you leave your church? They're always talking about money, and they're always trying to get us to join. So we vowed we would never ask people to join, and we don't. You can join, but we don't ask. And we never pass a collection plate. We don't push that. But the problem is Jesus talks about money. And so if I'm going to talk about Jesus, I kind of sort of have to talk about money. You're going to have to give me a little bit of latitude here because Jesus is very, very concerned about what you're doing with your money. And there's a reason for it, because what you're doing with your money tells him where your heart is. And if you can't tithe, you're saying, I don't trust God to provide for me. I need to keep this back. I'll take care of it and give God what I have left over. I'm better with my money than God is. And if that's where you are, then you're not trusting him to provide you. Let me give you a couple of Jesus quotes here. He says this, no servant can serve two masters. Either he'll hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth. It's a Jesus quote. He talks about money a lot. In fact, second most thing he talks about in the Bible. Number one thing he talks about is doing God's will. After that comes money. There's a reason for that, because he knows money will keep you from doing God's will. It will, because we just hold on to it, because I ain't getting my money. I'm not giving it to God. I got things to do with that. He also says this, if you haven't been faithful in the use of worldly wealth, who's going to give you real riches? He's like, money's nothing, folks. The true riches of the kingdom are the people of the kingdom. Who's going to trust you with that if I can't even trust you with money? And I get this all the time. Man, tithing is Old Testament law. Give me that. I love it when I get the amateur theologians throwing law at me. You know, it's, like, it's nothing but New Testament law. Old Testament law. Show me that in the New Testament. When I get that, I say, well, what do you want? You want Matthew or you want Luke? Because I can show it to you in the New Testament. No, you can't do that. Because I don't live under law, I live under grace. I'm like, man, that was beautiful. You got to make an Instagram of that. You know, you get a million likes. The problem is theologically incorrect. First of all, you have to understand this about tithing. It predates the law. Abraham tithed. That's before Leviticus. That's before Moses, Mosaic law. Second of all, Jesus talks about tithing. So it predates the law and it postdates the law. Jesus says this. He says, talking to scribes and Pharisees, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you tithe mint and dill and cumin. What is that about? Well, the Levites and the tribe of Levites, they weren't allowed to have land. It's kind of a strange thing. Because you remember there's 12 sons and there's 12 tribes of Israel. The Levites get no land when they go in the promised land. So who got the extra? Well, Joseph actually had a split. Joseph gets double reward. And so both of his sons get the land. And that's how they end up with the 12 tribes. But Levites get no land because they are to be set aside to be the priests. They're not supposed to work the field. They're supposed to do nothing except, you know, pray to God and be priests. So Levites didn't have land. What they had were little tiny flower pot gardens, you know, that they would keep for themselves, and they would grow herbs. You know, my wife does this. She grows herbs, right? You know, different herbs and, you know, mint and dill and cumin, and they really need parsley there too, honey, because we love the parsley. You know, it's like, you know, that's what we need, right? So what they said was, you know, what you were supposed to tithe on is what you call the increase. So they would plant stuff, and the increase of their garden, they would take 10% of that, and they would take it to the temple, and they'd sprinkle it around the altar. See us? We're tithing. And watch what Jesus says. He says, you neglected the weightier things, like, you know, justice and mercy. How about that? You know, while you were tithing your mint and cumin. And if he stops there, then I think everybody's saying this is just Old Testament law. It's absolutely right. Except Jesus doesn't stop there. He goes on. He says, these are the things you should have done without neglecting the others. Jesus really has an opportunity right here to overturn tithing. Instead, he doubles down on it. He says, you're supposed to do this plus that. He never says tithing. And I showed this to somebody and they went, well, technically, since Jesus said it, we weren't under grace yet because he hadn't died yet. Like, are you kidding me? I mean, it's just unbelievable to me. And they tell me I'm legalistic. I said, listen, something you need to know about Jesus Christ. He was the fulfillment of law and he was grace in sandals. He was both. And he's also our teacher. And anything he says is true. So don't give me this if Paul didn't write it. Like, Paul's writings are greater than the teaching of Jesus Christ. Paul would be shocked to hear it. But it's okay because, you know, you may have heard the expression that when an attorney has a good case, he argues the case. When he has a bad case, he argues the law. I don't know if you've ever heard that. I have absolutely no intention of arguing the law here today because I'm not interested in it. What I know is Jesus Christ said that giving is a heart matter. And what I know that God, his Father, said was, if you don't understand me as Jehovah Jireh, you're never going to get to the next step. If we don't trust him with that, then we can't trust him with anything. And that's really what it comes down to. And I can cut through all the arguments here because I've heard them for, you know, I've been preacher for more than a day. I've heard all the arguments that you possibly can imagine and then some. Because a lot of people aren't here right now. I heard their arguments too. And I have one little quick little story to tell you. And this actually happened, this true story, this happened last week. Bob, I didn't give you a heads up on this, but I think you're going to be okay with this. So last week, we're getting ready to do our Christmas Eve service. By the way, we had a record number here last week. We had 79 people last year. We were like busting at the seams, those of you who are here remember that. We prepared for a better crowd. We brought in more seats and stuff, and we had two services to try to help split that up, and it worked. But But we had 110 people here on Christmas Eve this past year. So that's a high watermark right now for Spirit Chapel. That first service is at 6 o'clock, and that Stass runs that, so he's over kind of do final, you know, moves and stuff. Donnelly's arrived. Which kind of time did you guys get here? 5:20 or something? 5:30? Because they wanted to make sure they got their seats, and they did. They picked the top three beanbags right there, and they were there, you know, so they were there. And so Stass is sitting at work, and I'm in the back doing some other things, getting some things ready. And I see Rebecca walk up to Stass and says, "I found this," and holds out her hand. And he looks up, and in her hand's a penny. He said, "Good for you." Goes back to work, you know. And she looks at the penny. She goes, "What should I do with this?" And he says, "Well, it's yours. You can do whatever you want with it." And so she looks at it again. He goes back to work. She goes, "What should I do with this?" He said, "Well, I guess you could put it in your pocket." And he says, "Or I guess if you want, you could go put it in the offering box. You could do that if you want. It's yours. You could do whatever you want with it." And then he goes back to work, and she looks at it again. And then she thinks for a minute. You see her kind of hip scotch jump dance, sort of how she walks over to the thing, and she plunks it into the collection box, right? Really sweet. Everybody's doing the same thing I did. I went, "Aw, you know." That's great. There's something I got to tell you, though, kind of the dark underside of all that. When Roberta Donnelly put that penny in that collection box, she outgave 60% of the people who were here that night with a penny. 60%. I got news for you. She gave more than 60% of the people who were here for the month of December. She has given more with that one act than some people who have been here for 4 years. Now, you can say what you want about why you don't give. I've heard them all. "I used to give the Catholic Church religiously, and I found they're using that money to defend, you know, the priests who are being caught in bad things." Okay. I don't know if you noticed, but this church isn't named Saint anything. You know, we're not a Catholic church here. It wasn't us. You know, and I always say, if you are going to a church that you don't feel comfortable giving to, don't. But stop going to that church. Go somewhere else. Because it's hurting your heart because of this. And I'm just going to say it. If you were outgiven by a six-year-old with a penny, you don't have a money problem. You have a heart problem. And you have to understand that, because the very first thing we need to get to is Jehovah Jireh. Why do you think that he fed them with manna in the wilderness? He could have fed them any way he wanted to. He could have given them a canteen that never ran dry. He does this with oil. He could do it with water. He could give them a backpack that magically fills up at mealtime with food. God can do that. He's God. He could have done anything he wanted. He chose to give them manna. What is manna? Manna is something you eat in the morning, you can't save it. It's enough to feed you for the day and no more. You can't even keep it for the next day. On the day before the Sabbath, he gave them double portion. That's manna. Why? Because he's trying to teach them, he'll take care of them, he'll provide. But when they reached the promised land, I don't know if you know this, the day before they entered the promised land, manna stopped. Because he doesn't need to teach them anymore. They've learned their lesson. Now it's time to move into the promised land, where they're going to plant crops that he can multiply and that they can have a harvest that benefits others besides just themselves. But he has to bring them to the point where they trust him completely and totally, to the point where he can take them to the promised land. And if you come to that point and you haven't learned that lesson, you're going to cycle back and go through again. I don't know about you, but I'm tired of eating manna. It was good. Don't get me wrong. Love to have God's manna. I love the fact he's providing. But I want to learn to the point where I can move on to the promised land. I am ready, because something else about the promised land is he says, he calls it his rest. I'm ready for the rest of God. I don't know about anybody else. I used to think that meant the rest of God, like there's more of God. Now I just think it's rest. And I'm like, oh, that sounds good to me. I think I would love to go and do that, you know. This is what Jesus also says. "Don't store up yourselves treasures on earth, where moths and vermin destroy, where thieves break in and steal. Store them up in heaven, where moths and vermin don't destroy. For," watch this, "where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." I always thought that was the other way around. I always thought he said, where your heart is, there your treasure goes. That's not what Jesus is saying. He's saying, where you put your money, your heart follows. So those of you who aren't putting your money in God's heart can't follow it. It's wherever your money is. You wake up in the morning and wherever your money is, whether it's Bitcoin or Ethereum or I don't even know what that is, to be honest with you. Or you know, the stock market, or your bank account, or your new car sitting out in front of your driveway. That's where your heart is. You don't believe me? Just watch somebody who buys a new car. They will wash it every day. You know, their heart is there. They can't get enough of it. Just stare at it. You know, just watch it. Watch a woman who gets an engagement ring. Watch how many times she just looks at that. You know, where's your heart? I'm not saying that, you know, that's an evil, wicked thing to have an engagement ring. I'm saying your heart has to turn to God if you're going to get to the promised land. It just simply has to. If you can't trust God with money, how are you going to trust him with your future? You can't say, I trust God with my future, and don't trust him with your money. You can't get from here to there without it. Listen, many will be buried in the wilderness simply because they never really knew who God was. Paul says this. He said, I am fully convinced that what he has promised, he is also able to perform. Do you believe that? That what he said he'll do, he can do and will do? Because if not, we don't believe in the God Almighty. We don't believe in El Shaddai. And we're like the Israelites. We don't know his ways. And I'm telling you, the reason that many promises never get fulfilled isn't because God isn't able, but because we're not ready. We have to get there if we're going to live a true Christian life. Jesus says this, these people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. Their worship's a farce. They teach man-made ideas as though they're commands from God. We need to stop saying what we believe, and we need to start acting and living what we believe. In other words, it's time we put our faith where our mouth is. Would you all please pray with me?